Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray. On this week's show, we've landed what looks to be a fairly exclusive interview, exclusive-ish at least as far as the tech press is concerned. Justine Bone will be joining us to explain why the company she works with, MedSec, decided to use vulnerability information on implantable medical devices to drive a short-selling scheme in partnership with Muddy Waters Research, a company that uses research it conducts to drive share prices in a direction they favour. So yes, Justine will pop in to discuss that whole caper soon. Reserve your judgment until you have heard that interview. This week's show is sponsored by Tenable Network Security. Big thanks to them. And we're doing something a little bit different in this week's sponsor interview. We'll be chatting with one of Tenable's customers, the CISO from the city of San Diego. The city of San Diego has just invested fairly heavily in Nessus, among other things, and the city's CISO, Gary Hayslip, will drop in to explain what he's been doing since he took over the position a few years ago. If you're a CISO, it's actually a pretty interesting interview. That team has to deal with everything from embedded devices in cop cars to control systems to its very own point of sale network. You know, citizens have to pay for government services and fines and things like that somehow, right? So all that's coming up later, but first off, it's time for a check of the week's news headlines with our good friend Dan Guido, who is filling in for Adam Boileau. And Dan, of course, the big news story of the week is this whole MedSec caper. I suppose we should recap it for the five listeners who haven't actually heard about it yet.
So MedSec found a couple of different vulnerabilities inside of pacemakers made from a wide number of different vendors and picked out the worst of the group and then offered those vulnerabilities and their report on them to a notorious short seller called Muddy Waters. And then Muddy Waters took out a couple of positions on that company and made the information public that was contained in MedSec's reports. So this is kind of unprecedented. People have talked about this for years as a way to monetize vulnerability information.
This was Weave's big model, right? When he got out of prison was, hey, I'm going to start up a company called, Trollolol LLC, which will find bugs in companies, will promote the bugs and short sell the shares. And everyone was like, ha, 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 yeah, that's real funny. And here we go a couple of years later, and that's exactly what's happened here. Someone has made what looks to be a fair amount of money out of security, you know, research. And, you know, here we are, and I'm not sure what I think of it.
Yeah, I think the real innovation here was actually picking the target. Because this doesn't work for every single company out there. It works for companies that are in highly regulated industries where a government agency can come in and club the vendor over the head. Because overwhelmingly, the market does not care about security issues. And you find this time and time again when big vendor or big retail company or retail bank, whatever, gets hacked, the market recovers. Like their stock price recovers within 3 months max. But in this case, there could be lasting repercussions because of government regulation, because of a recall. And that's really what makes this interesting. They timed it just perfect with a merger, including with that merger, where they could actually cause lasting damage on the company based on this disclosure.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a little bit of speculation, the merger between St. Jude Medical and some other group. I mean, we're talking about a $25 billion company here, and there's talk that that merger could be scuttled by this if the analysis by Muddy Waters is accurate, which says they're going to have to pull their products out of the market for 2 years to remediate and blah, blah, blah. Now, of course, it's in their interests to make it look as bad as possible, but still, this is causing some difficulty for them because, as you say, there's a regulator who, based on this, might come in and sort of start whacking them over the head.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, one other thing that I don't think people realized about this case as well is, like, when Weave was talking about doing this, when hackers have kind of fantasized about going off and doing this on their own, the reason why this is working is because they paired up with a company that has enough money to actually move the market around. They have enough money to make a short position that could actually cause some kind of financial impact. Like, this doesn't work with just hackers alone. You have to find the right partner. And in this case, MedSec found Muddy Waters, and that partnership is working.
Yeah.
So kind of, will this happen again? Is this going to, you know, are hackers going to run rampant and start short selling all this kind of stock? I would ask, like, with what money?
Yeah.
Because hackers don't have $10 million lying around to take out these kinds of positions on every company on the market.
Well, that's the thing. And if you're taking a leverage position, right? So 5% at 20-1 leverage, they would have doubled whatever money they put into it because we saw about a 5% drop in the stock price. So if they timed it right, they would have made a lot of money out of this. But this could be an alternative model for the disclosure of security information. And it's a very big stick. The other thing I worry about is that it could blow back on researchers and companies that's going to, you know, go back into 90s style anti-hackerism. What do you think about that?
I mean, it absolutely could, because if MedSec doesn't prevail in this argument, then it's going to make the next person that comes after them, it's going to reflect poorly on the next person that comes after them that maybe actually does have a case for it. Mm. So I think there's a lot of kind of cards riding on this particular case. So I'm really interested to see how it turns out.
Everyone seems to be jumping to an absolute moral position on this, you know, like a moral position, like what they did is right or wrong. I mean, I can't for the life of me make that call. What are your thoughts, though?
I don't have a problem with it. I mean, I don't think that the market was effectively regulating this company's activity. They already had issues in the past. They had, you know, DHS after them. They had other people report vulnerabilities to them, and they didn't change their behavior. So, you know, why take this card off the table? Why, you know, restrict yourself to methods that don't work?
Yeah, we should point out too that that MedSec didn't drop any proof of concept that would allow people to replicate the vulnerabilities. And of course, yeah, they didn't contact St. Jude Medical. That's the key thing in this story. They didn't contact St. Jude Medical. They contacted a hedge fund and went straight to the short selling. But look, let's move on, because that's this week's feature. And on to some other big news over the last week, which was this NSO, iPhone Zero Day, which was late last week. Which is pretty funny, because basically, you know, someone's very nice iPhone end-to-end remote jailbreak got burned, which, you know, that's gotta hurt.
Yeah. I mean, I think the kind of nonchalance in which they were sending around their iPhone jailbreak is kind of astounding. The fact that they were just SMS messaging this to people and hoping that they would click on it. And then they send it to this guy who's already paranoid as hell. And he just takes it and sends it to his friend at Citizen Lab. And then they find their jailbreak. It's just, for something that's so valuable, it seems like such a waste to deploy it in that manner.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, right? Because the guy you mentioned is a guy named Ahmed Mansour, who is a dissident blogger in the UAE. And this is a guy who's been owned by Finn Fisher. This is a guy who's been owned by Hacking Team, right? So you're going to send $1 million worth of Odo to that guy who already knows he's a target and he's been owned by this sort of stuff twice? I mean, it's just hilarious, right? And it's funny, right? Because it's going to make people think twice, you would think, before wasting valuable Odo on the guy, because he just burned about $1 million worth of product.
Yeah, I don't understand it. What I find interesting about this case, too, is that it's been about a week now, or maybe 2 weeks now, and nobody has a copy of the Zero Day. Everybody wants it, because everybody is concerned that they've received it. Lots of people have packet capture devices, but it sounds like Lookout is holding out and not sharing those samples, because I've tried to ping around. I would love to tear it apart.
Well,
we have the skills to do that, but nobody can get a copy. And the only thing that you've got is you've got these post-exploitation IOCs. So you basically have to sit around and wait until you get owned in order for somebody to actually like check to see if you've got it.
I think, you know, one thing, if I was Lookout, I might hold off a little bit until everyone's patched. But yeah, I think sharing that sample would be absolutely the right thing to do. It's not theirs. They didn't create it. It belongs to NSO. I mean, if you're going to burn their Ode, do you know what I mean? Have it patched. Like, you may as well share the sample. You're right. It would be the right thing to do. Moving on to some stuff within the civilian realm. And Swift has disclosed a bunch more attacks. This could be a new crew. It could, you know, copycats. It could be the old crew using their, you know, version 2.0 of their malware. But yes, attacks on the Swift network, the Swift financial messaging network, they're not going away.
Yeah, I totally think this is the same crew. I mean, they've got tools that work. They're going to keep using them until they don't. And there's plenty of banks out there for them to go after. So, you know, why not?
Yeah,
the beatings will continue until security improves.
I'm guessing they're using new malware though, right? Because I'm guessing Swift's solution would have been like, here's a bunch of IOCs and here's some crappy thing to detect them with. And they were like, awesome. Let's give ourselves a pat on the back and go for a coffee. But, it doesn't take too much to get around that sort of Band-Aid approach, does it?
No, not at all. Mm. I don't have very high hopes for that network at the moment.
Well, I mean, but they're all crap. Do you know what I mean? Like, what's better?
Yeah, no, it's going to take some will to act in larger ways than people have thought up right now. That's always the problem with security. Everybody knows what to do and nobody actually wants to do it. So, you know, having lockdown devices, shipping people hardware that's kind of impermeable, like an iPad, you know, not using general purpose computing equipment, actually auditing all your protocols and writing them over again if they don't work. And, you know, it's funny because we see this kind of redevelopment happen all the time where like everybody decides that Node.js is the new thing and everyone rewrites this giant standard library that you need to use for Node.js, but we never see the same kind of redevelopment activity happen in security. We just kind of stick with what we've got and sit on our hands, which I am not a fan of.
And come up with some IOCs and deploy some crappy technology to detect them with. Yay!
Yeah.
Ars Technica is reporting, look, a bunch of outlets are reporting there's been some shenanigans. Russia is apparently all up in United States voter registration systems, to which my first question is, like, why would they bother? What's possible sort of information would they get from there that would be useful?
I thought about this as well. If you want to be really manipulative and you want to start modifying voter behavior, voter records in order to, like, disallow people from voting, or maybe if you want to forge a couple records that look legit, you need to actually have information about who's registered where. That's the most evil scenario that I can come up with. But you know, who knows really what this is about, because all you've got is you've got a couple of IPs that are in Russia running SQL map against some server that was on the internet.
Oh, so clearly government state-sponsored stuff, right? Russia is the new China, right? Russia did it is the new China did it. And, you know, we saw this with, was it JP Morgan Chase that got popped and everyone was saying it was the Russian government and it just turned out to be some, like, crooks?
Yep, that's exactly it. Yeah, I mean, I have no idea. And people are kind of, like, patting themselves on the back, too, about how this is all, like, oh, great, information sharing. Like, we're using the multi-state ISAC, and we're getting all this information out to everybody. But the information is, like, look out for SQL map. Did I really need threat information sharing to tell everybody to look out for SQL map? Like, I'm not feeling too good right now about the state of our election system.
Joseph Cox has a story up at Motherboard talking about how voter records get hacked all the time and you can just buy them anyway. But yeah, as you say, if you were looking to manipulate things, that would be handy access. There's been a big leak from a submarine maker, which is a subsidiary of Thales, DCNS, subsidiary or partner, I can't remember, but DCNS is a French submarine maker, and a whole bunch of details on submarines that they were developing for India have leaked. I mean, it's being described as a Snowden-scale leak. The Australian newspaper has published a lot of the documents. I'm not really clear on why they've published documents on submarines. Like it's super duper public interest. I mean, reporting on the leak is one thing, but yeah, they have published a bunch of documents about these subs because, of course, here in Australia, we've just gone into Australian $50 billion contract. That's Australian dollars over a bunch of years to build us some new submarines. But this looks like, yeah, this is pretty bad.
Yeah. I mean, defense contractors have some of the most extended supply chains out of any other kind of organizational system on the planet. And it's very easy for any one of those contractors to screw up and leak all your docs. This is a problem that's not specific to this particular vendor. I mean, everybody has to deal with this, and it's a really tough problem to solve.
Ars Technica is reporting that a congressman has been urging the FCC to crack down on telcos to, quote, fix SS7. But I'm wondering how you do that, given that the problem seems to be the protocol itself. Like, how would you actually fix SS7?
This is going to be a really painful transition. I mean, everybody's known that SS7 has been total garbage since like 1975, and it's probably not going to change until like 2075 because it's just so ingrained in our telephony systems. I just think it's funny that everybody's paying attention to this now because somebody came up with the right demo to get Congress to care. They hacked the congressman with SS7 because there's been plenty of research presentations about this going back quite a long time.
A lot of it's packaging, isn't it?
Yeah, a lot of this is packaging. I do think it's probably a good time to mention, the last time I was on your show, we talked about how NIST was no longer recommending SMS for two-factor authentication, and it kind of plays into, maybe that was in response to some of these issues becoming public. Maybe it forced their hand.
There's some stuff kicking around, some rumors kicking around among people with interesting jobs that say that China is using the cell numbers in the OPM breach to do a lot of SS7 stuff, right? So I think there's some stuff going on behind the scenes that I'm technically not supposed to know about. Hi, everyone. Please don't tap my phones. there's a lot of actors doing some pretty large-scale stuff with SS7. And, of course, there's some other funny stuff going on as well. Like, the IMEI numbers, numbers for all of these, like, class one, class two encrypted telephones that, politicians and officials use, they're made by defense contractors and stuff, and they have very limited IMEI ranges, right? So you can actually scan networks for them and find them and then start tracking their physical location. So there's lots of fun stuff happening in the intelligence community with SS7. So that could be something to do with it.
Yeah, you know, I think it's really easy to get off using regular cell phone calls. Like I can't really remember the last time that I had a regular cell phone call. Everything's either FaceTime audio or it's Skype with, you know, you and I right now. But for SMS messages, I can't seem to find a way to get rid of them. Like I can turn off my cellular and I can only have data cell phone calls, but I can't turn off SMS messages and like, you know, not allow them to come into my phone.
Yeah.
And like force everybody to use iMessage.
Or WhatsApp, right? Like they do in Brazil. You know, when I was in Brazil, it was 4 months there, right? 4 months in Brazil, I probably made 2 phone calls the whole time I was there. The rest of the time, as you say, you know. So I wonder how relevant it's going to be into the future. But there's a lot of stuff happening with SS7.
Yeah, maybe that's how we kill SS7.
Yeah,
everybody just agrees to get on FaceTime.
Exactly, right? Moving to Europe now, and apparently France and Germany want to have some sort of, you know, decryption law, as they say. This is, you know, the crypto wars are sort of bubbling around. They're simmering all around the world. But yes, France and Germany, the latest to say, hey, we need to address this.
You know, I'm a member of the Responsible Cybersecurity Coalition, which is a group of companies that's trying to make inform our Congress people about this issue. And this is something where a lot of the international community is going to have to pick up the slack as well, because it's not just in the U.S. You're going to see many more countries go down this path pretty soon.
Dropbox apparently got popped. This is a bit of a historical breach, but 60 million account details have become available or were stolen. Are they available? Has it been dumped yet?
I think they're available. I didn't actually download any dumps to take a look, but I know I saw some people that had, so I assume they're out there somewhere.
Yeah, it's an old breach, but it's the extent to which they got owned that we didn't quite know yet. 60 million accounts.
Yeah, you really ought to be using a password manager by now. I mean, it's 2016. The dump's from 2012, so do yourself a favor, and sometime in the last 4 years, hopefully you've converted over to using a password manager, despite anything that Tavis says about them on Twitter.
Vice Motherboard has broken the cardinal rule of journalism by writing a story about something that didn't happen. It looks like they sent in an FOIA request in England to find out, you know, if hospitals who were affected by ransomware were paying up, and apparently they're not. So that's just interesting that there are organizations out there that have a "we will not pay ransom" policy. Alex Jones, that crazy guy, the guy in America who's all like 9/11 killed JFK, wake up sheeple, that guy got owned. His forums and stuff got owned and all of the passwords, I think something like 50,000 users, details on 50,000 users got popped, so his InfoWars site. It's kind of funny, right, because I'm waiting for ThreatButt to come out and do a CrowdStrike attribution to the Illuminati.
Yeah, those guys must be freaking out right now. I can't imagine who they think did it.
Yeah. Who do you think did it?
Probably the space ants. I mean, space ants run the planet anyway.
Yeah.
So I've heard.
My money's on space ants. 1.7 million Opera browser users have been told to reset their passwords. So that's just, look, I mean, it's this week in breach news, right?
So the Opera guys got a lot of flack a couple weeks ago because they started up a VPN service as well. So not only are they collecting people's passwords, but they're also centralizing people's network traffic through their servers. So I think now would be a good time to reevaluate your usage of some of the services that Opera's using or that Opera's offering to you, because that just like, that was one big target, but they have another big target just waiting for somebody else to hack. So I'm looking forward to the next release.
Ars Technica also reports that a hacker who stole 3 million credit card numbers, who's been dinged for it, their father is a Russian lawmaker's son. So that's going to make for possibly some awkward family conversations and maybe some nervous judges. We'll just have to see how that one plays out. The Angler Exploit Kit, which was a, you know, tool of choice for many in the underground for a long time, is no more.
Yeah, top of the line kit. I've been following that one for a couple of years. They had some good stuff. They were one of the few crews that was able to modify some of the exploits they put in the kit and had some innovative obfuscation techniques. And they did the software as a service thing for a while. So that'll probably have a big impact with their crew getting rolled up.
Yeah. So is that what happened here? A bunch of them got arrested and it just sort of fell out of maintenance.
Yeah. They arrested the guys behind the Lurk Trojan, and it turned out they were the same guys behind Angler. So good job.
Yeah, right. Bye-bye, Angler. But, you know, opportunity knocking for the next people, right? So Wired has a really interesting piece here about how you can trick facial recognition logins with by 3D printing, like, people's heads based on photos that you pull from their, like, social media profiles and stuff. Because we know that quite often they're, you know, they're pretty good at determining when a 2D image is a 2D image, so it won't... You know, you can't just hold a photo of someone in front of a camera and have it fool the, you know, facial recognition. But, you know, if you do create some sort of 3D model of someone's head, you can hold it up and that works. That's kind of cool, right?
Yeah, I think it's really great. You know, a lot of these products claim to do some kind of motion detection, like, or rather liveness detection, where you have to move or smile or, you know, move your eyes in a certain way. But all that stuff is probably pretty easy to programmatically simulate. Once you've got somebody hooked up to a giant set of VR goggles, I mean, anything's possible. So I don't put a lot of stock in this facial recognition stuff going forward. I think we're starting to see the end of it.
Ars is reporting that there is a new type of decryption attack against HTTPS and OpenVPN. Is this like one of those really crazy edge case crypto things that isn't really useful in the real world, or is this a big deal?
This is incredibly an edge case. I mean, it is not really a threat for HTTPS at all, because you need to have TripleDesk on the server. You need to have a client that requests TripleDesk. You need to have application support for a long-lived session that can last for days or weeks at a time. And then need to be able to collect 785 gigs of data in order to crunch the numbers you need to break through the crypto.
Mars and Jupiter need to be aligned. You need to be standing on the south side of a hill facing, you know, in exactly the middle of spring at the solstice. And, you know, yeah, I get it, right? So
yeah. So VPNs, though, this could be an issue. So if you have a point-to-point VPN where it's set up to use TripleDesk and you're just tunneling traffic all day, every day, like from now till infinity, that could be a real issue. You know, I think what's really interesting about this is that there's a lot of different software out there that uses older protocols that you don't really see. Like if you have VPN software, you might not actually check what protocols it's using. You just accept the defaults. And, you know, the Windows VPN uses TripleDesk by default. Apple Mail does TLS 1.0. Like there's a lot of things that are just kind of hiding there that you don't have a good ability to inspect that are using all this old, outdated legacy crypto.
Yeah, right.
So I doubt that this will be the end of attacks like this, kind of biting at the heels of all these older protocols and finding it being used in real life.
Yeah, right. Oh, now there's been some research done. It's called USB, as in USB and then EE, which is like kind of like a framework designed to get files in and out of air gaps using USB malware, right? So there's like a bit of a framework for that now.
Yeah, I mean, this is a great little research project. I think it's really innovative. You know, I'd love to see it turned into a pen testing tool for those, you know, really high touch red team engagements. Not something that, you know, you're going to see in the wild, because these kinds of physical attacks are, you know, pretty hard to pull off. So don't freak out.
Here's one that would, you know, make the late Barnaby Jack, you know, very happy. Someone has figured out how to use a malicious EMV chip to own ATMs and like put them into their, you know, debug modes and stuff to do all sorts of crime stuff. It's awesome.
Yeah, this is pretty awful. I mean,
you mean awesome.
This is not supposed to. I do mean awesome. Yeah, this is stuff that's hard to study. The skills to do so are, you know, very hard to find. And I'm glad that somebody's looking into this kind of attack surface, because it's widely deployed, high value, and we all use it. So good work on the Ripper guys.
Yeah, they'd been doing that in Thailand. They got away with about $378,000 from ATMs at banks across Thailand. So nice caper, plus one. Yeah. Well done. Apparently, a family of malware called Bashlight has infected 1 million IoT devices. I mean, that's not a particularly interesting story. The reason I put it in this week's show notes is because, you know, it's owning up things like web-connected video cameras, DVRs, stuff like that, and they're just using them for DOS attacks. But this is exactly what people used to do to Windows 95 and 98 and, you know, XP boxes back in the day, right? So what I think we're going to see with IoT stuff is that people will own them for doing dumb stuff like sending spam and doing DDoS attacks, and then gradually they're going to figure out more and more uses for them. Is that, you know, for those own devices? Is that how you see it going?
I'm not quite sure. I mean, I do think that they've got a lot of potential for experimentation, because all these devices are never going to receive patches. Like if you can hack into them today, you're going to be able to hack into them 10 years from now. Because as you said, most of them are cameras and DVRs. So at the very least, it does provide this kind of, you know, experimental population for you to try out some of these new attacks and techniques on. I don't know exactly know where this is going.
Who knows? It might be someone doing another internet survey. You remember that? That was awesome.
Yes, that was great.
Oh, someone out there has upgraded the latest, upgraded the Shadow Brokers Cisco ASA exploit to work against like current versions, which is, pretty funny. You know, the NSA just copped an upgrade to their exploit kit, but it kind of shows you that the exploit kit was out of date, doesn't it?
Well, it shows you the exploit kit was out of date, but that the exploit itself was extremely high quality. I mean, The fact that it not only doesn't crash an unsupported version, but it actually just magically works on an unsupported version is amazing. I think Gruck mentioned this in your last week's show, where people were all concerned about their coding style is so bad and, laughing at them for their help options and whatever. But you know what? The stuff works. So pat on the back for whoever wrote that stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And finally, Motherboard reports that a hotel left thousands of customers' credit cards online for all to see. It's just nice to have the funny story to end on for the week. Now, don't forget, links to everything are in this week's show notes. But Dan Guido, that is actually it for the week's news. Thank you very much for joining us, and I'm sure we'll have cause to speak to you again soon.
Thanks again, Patrick.
That was Dan Guido of Trail of Bits there. Of course, Trail of Bits does some fairly high-end research and development, but they also do red teaming, app assessments, and consulting. They're based in New York City. So, if you're based there as well and you're looking around for security consultants, you should think about giving them a call. Okay, it is time for this week's feature interview now. As you heard in the news, just under a week ago, a company named MedSec pulled off a hell of a caper in partnership with another firm called Muddy Waters. Muddy Waters Research is an interesting company. It basically does research that I would mostly describe as being very similar to investigative journalism. But instead of selling newspapers with their scoops, they use the information to execute profitable trades. I'll give you an example. In 2011, Muddy Waters exposed some seriously dodgy book cooking at the Sino Forest Corporation. They planned a short sell of the company's stock, then dropped the research. In the end, they made a tidy profit. The company didn't do so well because it turned out the allegations, the research, there was a lot to it. Now, for those who aren't familiar with finance terminology, short selling is an arrangement whereby you profit if the share goes down. So in simple terms, you more or less borrow the shares from a shareholder, you sell them, you pocket the cash, and then you buy the shares back after a certain period of time to return them to whoever you borrowed them off, right? So if the shares are cheaper, when you buy them back, you pocket the difference. If they're more expensive, obviously if they're more expensive, you wind up losing out on the arrangement. That's just a very simple explanation about how you can profit from a share price going down. Well, Muddy Waters has just executed another short sell against a company called St. Jude Medical, a medical devices company. Abbott Laboratories, a pharmaceutical company, recently agreed to acquire St. Jude for $25 billion. So, as you can probably tell, they're not exactly a small company. Over the last week, Muddy Waters was able to drive St. Jude Medical's share price down by something like 5% by announcing that a team of researchers from a company named MedSec had found a series of critical vulnerabilities in St. Jude's medical devices. The research note that Muddy Waters released claimed St. Jude would have to pull certain products from the market for periods of up to 2 years, that remediation costs would be substantial, and regulators would move in to give them a big whack, so on and so forth. All bad news, doom and gloom. And I'm sure they probably overdid it a little bit because that's, that would suit their purposes in that time. Of course, St. Jude has issued statements saying, well, it's all not true, these problems are trivial, yada, yada, yada. But of course, they did take a hit on the market. Well, Justine Bone joins me now. Justine has had a long and successful career in information security. She worked for the GCSB in New Zealand, later worked for ISS X-Force. She was the CEO of Immunity Inc. and has done a bunch of other stuff, really. But these days, yes, she works with MedSec, the company that did the research into St. Jude's medical devices. Justine joined me for this interview over a fairly crappy cell phone connection, it must be said, but here's what she had to say.
A team of researchers set up shop here in Miami a year and a half ago, and their plan and what they executed on after getting some funding was to focus on the healthcare space and medical devices in particular. So they spent a good 18 months researching these medical devices. And when it got to the point that they needed to bring some of this research to light and they wanted to start solidifying the business plan when it came to the solutions side of the house, they reached out to me and they asked if I would consider coming on board for the sort of, you know, next phase of the company. And because I was really interested in the work that these guys had been doing, I accepted. And of course, I enjoy spending a lot of my time here with my family in Miami, so that was also an extra win as well. Because previously, I've been working and commuting between New York and Miami, so nice side benefit.
Any commute involving an aeroplane just doesn't sound like a commute to me, but that's that's just me, right?
There's a lot of people who do it in Miami, believe it or not. A lot of people have their day jobs up in New York.
Do not want. So how do we go from, you know, group of people in a startup coming up with some vulnerabilities in medical devices to, I know, let's go to a hedge fund and short some stock. Like, help me make that leap. So, I mean, you know, it's one thing to be in a startup. I'd imagine maybe their original plan, the typical plan that people would normally have in this situation, is to release some information around the vulnerabilities, turn it into marketing hype, and then try to sell consulting services to the medical device manufacturers. This is the way it's all been done. How did it turn out so differently this time?
Well, it really came down to, in this case, St. Jude Medical's track history with regards to security research and security in their infrastructure. So they've got a terrible track history, to be frank. And, you know, many of us fondly remember Barnaby Jack. We know that he sat down with St. Jude years ago. We don't know if his research was aligned with our findings, because unfortunately he never fully published that work. But, you know, we know that these guys over at St. Jude have been exposed to this stuff in the past, and that was followed by a DHS investigation, followed by FDA, you know, recommendations all issued out to these medical device manufacturers. We saw evidence that the other manufacturers had sort of set up, taken notice and built in some protection to their technology suite. Not at all with St. Jude. And we basically had no confidence that by reaching out to St. Jude, we weren't going to end up in a sort of a Volkswagen-type scenario where, you know, it would be hushed up by one mechanism or another, probably something related to litigation of some kind. Not only the vulnerabilities wouldn't be fixed, but the security, the evidence of the disastrous security culture or lack thereof at St. Jude would just continue to persist. So we wanted to sort of turn everything upside down and really compel these guys to take notice. At the same time, we wanted to make sure that the public were brought into the conversation. And by the public, of course, I address patients in particular, who, you know, sort of get left out of the loop on a lot of these conversations. And by doing it in the way that we've done it, we've really allowed folks out there to understand more about the risks with these implants in particular and the rest of the ecosystem, without it just being a sort of a closed conversation between researchers and manufacturers.
Now, look, I mean, I'm completely in two minds about this, because on one hand, you've used a very big stick, a very big new stick, in fact, to give these guys an almighty whack with. And I think, well, you know, considering there are vulnerabilities and we haven't seen the details of the vulnerabilities, but presuming there are vulnerabilities in these products that allow, you know, people like Barnes to come and murder, death, kill people with a laptop. Okay. On one hand, I think it's great that that stick has come out and that, you know, you're giving them a good whack with it. On the other hand, you know, there's this profit motive here. And the whole thing just smells a bit shady, right? And that seems to be the general thing that's happened in the security discipline right now, is there's no consensus about whether or not what you've done is great or really, really shady. Do you understand why people are having a hard time figuring out where to land on this?
Well, people are used to things being done a certain way. And, you know, folks like, you know, Josh Corman, Katie Mazuris, others over at HackerOne have done an amazing job in recent years of, you know, pushing forward disclosure programs around things like bug bounties. And I'm not opposed whatsoever to that approach when that approach is suitable to vulnerability disclosure. What I am saying is that there might be some circumstances, and this was one of them, where that approach doesn't work, So, you know, we took a different route. We're a commercial entity. We've incurred huge costs over the last 18 months to conduct this research, which is heavily hardware-based, as you can imagine,
yeah.
In addition to all of our legal analysis and our legal costs, which have been just mind-blowing. So, yeah, we would like to recover some of that upfront investment. And this is, you know, one way to go about doing that. It's going outside, you know, traditional behavior. I find a couple of things really interesting here. One is that we're having a lot of conversation about whether this was okay to do. Was it ethical? What's the implications of that? I really wish that a few more folks would start thinking about the ethics of a profitable public company continuing to knowingly make insecure, critical healthcare systems over a period of at least 4 years, probably longer. I wish that a few more people would question the ethics of that. I really wish some more folks would start to focus more on, as I said, these large companies taking responsibility or not. And then when they know that they've got security problems, these are life-critical systems, and they know they've got fundamental issues in these systems, and they do nothing. Where's the ethics in that? Well, they continue to profit off the sale of them, by the way.
Are you concerned, though, that this might have sort of fired the starter's pistol on, you know, a mad rush of other people, maybe with less, you know, pure motives, rushing in to do exactly the same thing? Because don't forget, this is Weave's business model. This is Andrew Orenheimer, Nazi extraordinaire. This was his business model from years ago, Trollololol LLC, okay? This was his plan. So do you worry now that if you guys prove this is a successful template, that it's going to cause a lot of really shitty behavior?
Look, I can't speak to exactly what Weave's business proposal was because I don't keep up with his proposals. But what I do rather than worry is I hope that the idea that this is possible will compel these public companies into taking more responsibility for the integrity and the security of their products.
Do you worry that because, you know, we've seen a lot of talk on Twitter from people like securities lawyers using words like insider trading, things like that, because it's specialist knowledge. Are you at all concerned with any potential legal fallout from this, or are you confident that you received good advice going in?
Yeah. Well, I mentioned those legal expenses earlier. We've received first, second, and third opinions on just about every scenario you can possibly think of from some of the leading lawyers in the States on these issues. This is not an insider trading situation, and we've had so many assurances to that effect that I'm confident that we're in a good position on that. Short selling is not illegal. People might have their opinions on whether it's appropriate or not, but you know, folks out there that do this, and this is a part of that model.
So when will does the company now have a full copy of your research? Because as I understand it, you just said there are bugs. You didn't actually release any proof of concept or technical details. You know, it was just more making the noise, and then there was the short sell. But have you now given a copy of the research to the company?
We're working with the FDA and the DHS on that process. So we've not heard from St. Jude themselves. They've not reached out to us. But we believe that the specific DHS team that we're working with is going to be passing through the information that St. Jude needs to better understand our specific findings. It doesn't mean they're going to understand all of their security problems, because we've only scratched the surface.
And what sort of things have you found? I mean, because it's very high level, the descriptions in the research released by the firm doing the short selling.
Right. Right, which we did for a reason, right? Like we had in mind that we wanted to release enough information to, you know, compel St. Jude into action and to allow folks to get an idea as to their level of exposure with the technology. But we didn't obviously release all the details. So we've done everything in the stack and everything across the ecosystem. You know, the ecosystem's basically an at-home monitoring unit, the implants themselves, the programmer, which the physicians use, the communications protocol between all of these things that, of course, is tied back into the manufacturer's infrastructure. And so we found issues all over the place. First of all, you know, the research process itself was incredibly easy. The bar was incredibly low. So, you know, examining the hardware, extracting the firmware, extracting the software, looking at the, you know, data sitting on the hard drive, no encryption. Then you just extend out to the, now you're in a position where you can understand things like the communications protocol, right? So now we were reproducing the protocol. There's no authentication, so impersonations, not complicated to achieve. So now we're able to build fuzzes. Or at least, you know, replay traffic and start, you know, targeting the other devices such as the implants. Then those things start falling over.
Mm. You know, I mean, this sounds pretty familiar. I saw Barnes's work on medical devices. Actually, he presented some of that stuff twice in Australia. And it seems, yeah, look, you're telling me a familiar story, that's for sure.
There you go.
But where did you get the medical devices? Because in his case, he was like, yeah, okay, well, I got this one here, you know, and apparently this one costs like 120 grand, you know. So where did you actually get the medical devices to test in the first place?
We entered into a couple of relationships with some physicians. So, for example, Dr. Himal Nayak, he's a cardio-electrophysiologist, or basically a heart rhythm specialist out of the University of Chicago Medicine. So we entered into a relationship with him, and under his umbrella, we were able to obtain access to certain equipment. But even with that said, some of these things are, you know, a little difficult to get our hands on. I mean, to be frank with you, we've run out of pacemakers right now.
Yeah. Did you brick any?
We bricked them all.
Oh, wow. Yeah, right.
So.
And that would have cost a bit, I'd imagine.
But, you know, other devices such as the at-home device, you know, and the program are available via other outlets, you know, on eBay and whatnot, so.
Now, look, can we get any sort of hint as to what type of profit you guys might have turned in this instance? You mentioned a lot of costs. What sort of gross did you wind up?
Look, I don't know if we're going to be profitable. I do not know. And to be absolutely frank with you, I don't pay much attention to that, believe it or not. It's not how I'm wired. Maybe wrongly so. I'm more interested in the technology and the research and, you know, changing the way things are done and holding folks accountable. If we recover our costs, great. If we make some profit, we'll no doubt reinvest it. We've got a lot of goals and plans to build out a solution side of our company. And that's where, you know, if we walk away with anything extra, that's where you'll see that going.
Well, it's been a hell of a caper so far, and I'm sure that this isn't done yet. I have a feeling we'll be talking about this for a little bit more time to come. But Justine Bone, thank you very much for joining us on the show. I know how busy you are. I really do appreciate you giving us the time.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Justine Bone there of MedSec. Big thanks to her for finding the time to talk to me about that. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now, and we're doing something a little bit different this week. Normally, we speak with someone from the sponsoring organization, but this week we're actually chatting with one of the sponsor's customers, a Tenable customer. Gary Hayslip is the CISO for the city of San Diego. Previously, he worked for the DOD, also in a CISO role. And about the time he wrapped up his MBA a few years ago, he decided he'd had enough of working for the federal government and took the job as CISO for the city of San Diego. And boy, did he get a shock when he got there. Well, not a shock, I guess. You know what you're getting into when you take that type of job. And the problems he deals with are exactly the type of problems you'd expect. It's a massive network, you know, 40 departments, a zillion different types of devices on it, from HVAC to normal workstations, to the computers used in police cars, to the massive POS network they run to let citizens pay for things like government services and fines. So he's wound up partnering, and this is really interesting, right? Gary's had a lateral approach to getting things in order. He partnered with a bunch of startups in California to essentially swap software for case studies, which is an interesting and, as I say, lateral approach. But there is a Tenable angle in all of this that's pretty interesting, because when you're confronted by such a diverse bunch of systems, you know, spread across dozens of departments, rolling out a comprehensive vulnerability scanning and management solution is actually just a good way to understand where you need to prioritize your efforts. It's what he did. He's used Nessus to do this, which is why Tenable is happy for us to talk to him instead of them this week. And as I said at the top of the show, if you are a CISO dealing with similar issues, you'll probably get quite a lot out of this. I spoke to Gary by Skype for this interview, and here's what he had to say.
You know, about a year into it, once I really started getting a handle on what I was dealing with, was that I realized how in-depth all of this, you know, how disparate all of these different technologies were. And I knew from a risk perspective, honestly, it scared the shit out of me because I was looking at all of these interesting technologies and that cities don't get rid of anything. They keep stuff forever. Mm. And if it works, why change? But that is not going to you cannot go ahead and have that mentality with today's threats. With the new types of things that I was seeing, the types of attacks that we were dealing with, I realized, we had no choice. We had to update ourselves. And what was cool at that time was the Department of IT was into a renaissance period. We had a new CIO coming in. They were giving us new positions for a CTO and a contract manager, and we're standing up service delivery, and we were putting ITIL in place to give us a framework to start with. And then I told them I was going to use the NIST cybersecurity framework to go ahead and assess maturity-wise, how bad it was and what we needed to work on. And so as we started getting into it, what I found was that we had a lot of really good stuff that we were doing well, but we didn't have anything that we were doing really well. And there were some security controls I was looking at that I realized that were really in their infant stages because we didn't have anything to measure. It lacked visibility. And when I realized and we started looking at data, and it dawned on me that I had 5 petabytes of data. Some of that data goes back decades, and then it dawned on me. I said, okay, I'm going to have to build a program from scratch. As we're building out, I'm building out these networks and I'm building out my teams, and I start getting more and more visibility into how deep the rabbit hole goes, per se. And that's when I realized, there was a couple of things I realized, okay, I really need a full security suite. But I don't have funding yet. So I started going ahead and working on getting grant funding. But then I came up with an idea. Hey, I want to partner with startups. And I started asking the city attorneys, hey, we've got this huge cybersecurity startup community here. And we've got several of them here that would, that would love to go ahead and honestly give me the technology for free. We could work some deals here. Would you be willing? And it was interesting. All the way up to the mayor's office, no one had ever asked. They were looking at me like, what would you really want to do? And I'm like, well, how about this? How about we work in agreement with them? The data's ours, but they get to use the city's networks as a test bed. My teams will work with their teams and help them develop. And if their venture capitalists need to talk to somebody, I'll be happy to talk to their VCs and get them funding, but I get them free for a year. And then at the end of a year, if we decide to keep them and we become paying customers, I expect at least a 60% discount.
And that gets them a case study as well, right? Which for an early stage company is very, very useful. So which ones did you push forward with?
Well, and what we did was I started looking at, right away I knew I needed visibility to basically see what was going on in the networks, to be able to kind of track what the bad guys were doing to help us fight, to help us be able to, protect our networks. And there was already several startups here. One of them was Packet Sled, and another one was called Attack IQ, and another one was called Cyberflow Analytics. And each of them had unique pieces of the puzzle where they would fit into the suite that we were building. And they would actually help us meet some of the security controls that we were trying to put in place. And so we basically worked agreements with them. And as we were putting them into place, then I was looking at, okay, I needed an overall platform so that I could go ahead and start assessing, where our risks were at, so we could start testing, continuously testing. Because one of the things as this was going on, as I was building out my security program, our IT department was working with our 40 departments, and all 40 of my departments by this time, about a year and a half in, to being here at the city, we had this huge change going on where now city, our departments were upgrading. Everybody was upgrading the new technologies. We had a lot of new cloud, like SaaS solutions coming in, like Salesforce and Acela. So you have all of these new solutions coming in. We have 400 plus applications in our application portfolio, and easily about 280 of them were being rewritten or replaced, within 18 months. I mean, all of this level of change is going on. And I realized right away that as a CISO, I'm not going to have a stable risk baseline anytime soon at all. because of just the rate of change that was going. And then at the same time, the city of San Diego was shifting to become a smart city. And we were starting to do some of these intelligent infrastructure projects, just amazing technologies. But then I realized, you know, I'm bringing these new technologies in, but I have these legacy technologies in place, and I need a framework to manage all of this. So we're using the NIST framework, but even with that, you have to continually scan, continually monitor, continually remediate issues that you're going to find because of all of this change. Nothing's going to be stable for a while.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, rolling out all the Tenable gear would just be a really, would have been a really handy way to get a handle on the scope of the problem. Is that, a lot of the appeal?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Tenable ended up, you know, and it is now. We have it tied into the suite. We have it tied into our SIEM solution. We've been using Splunk. We're testing Sumo Logic right now. But, you know, Nessus has become our primary solution that we use daily, where you're constantly scanning. You know, I don't trust anything. I'm constantly looking at the networks, you know, because of...
Well, you've got so much diversity in your environment that, you know, you're never going to be able to stay on top of that any other way, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know, between the cop cars running probably XP embedded something awful from, you know, the 90s versus your POS terminals versus your enterprise networks, which are probably lagging behind because they're government versus this versus that. You know, you're going to be dealing with a lot of CVEs, and where the risk is going to change. Like your daily task list is going to basically change pretty rapidly based on the output of your Nessus gear, I'm guessing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, in fact, when we first started doing Nessus, that was one of the things that we decided to do was we were going to do this massive XP project. And we actually got the whole city upgraded onto Windows 7 and Windows 10 by, it was like November of last year. You know, we're talking 14,000 laptops, desktops, and tablets. We got everything upgraded. And, you know, and the nice thing about Nessus is that, you know, with the scans that you're doing, and we're also doing the passive scanning too, is that you can see, you know, where the assets are and the applications on the assets, and you can see what areas need to be remediated. And we spent a lot of time, you know, when we started using Nessus, you know, my biggest thing was coming from DOD, I was used to, if I did any scans like with Nessus and I had a bunch of P1s, you know, a bunch of, you know, critical hits, I could use those as a hammer and go beat up a department and say, fix this now. You know, you guys are putting us at risk. You can't do that here at a city. You know, cities are, you know, the city of San Diego is a $4 billion business. We're running 24/7. I can't go to a department and tell them, hey, you got to stop business operations and shut down to fix this. You know, what ended up happening was I had to totally shift the way I view cybersecurity. And I had to basically look at the fact that I'm running these scans. I have found these vulnerabilities. They're criticals. But the risk is not mine. The risk is the business. It belongs to the business entity, to the department. And it was my job to come talk to the departments and help them understand the risk and the impact of their business services if we do not fix them. And then working with them as a partner, we start figuring out, okay, which ones can we fix now because they don't impact anything? Which ones do we need to go ahead and do on a weekend? So that we can kind of plan around business operations, you know, and what ended up happening is that they all of a sudden thought cyber was pretty cool. You know, cyber's sexy. They really got into what we were doing. And now they start owning their risk. And when they start owning their risk, you all of a sudden have these partners. They're not trying to hide stuff for me anymore. Mm. I got so, you know, just sick of shadow IT.
The other thing is, right, like I'd imagine too that the number of CVEs just emanating out of one department or another or one project or one network or another, that gives you a reasonable baseline on where you need process improvements and management improvements as well. I mean, I guess that's kind of what you were getting at with that last answer, right?
Oh, yeah. But think about this, though, is that if you start scanning like and you do the departments individually, and then you go ahead and you get the list, you know, of CVEs so you can look at risk per department. And then you go ahead and you let the other departments to see how they stack up with the other departments. Then there's competition. Mm. Then they're like, oh, shit, I don't want to be the one at the top. I want to be one of these guys, you know. Then it gives visibility into the risk. And then they start understanding that, you know, hey, I'm not here to be the bad guy and tell you you can't buy this technology. We've got a 5-year baseline of where we're going for the city, and we want you to stay within that baseline. But you have operations, you have services that you want to provide to the citizens. I just want you to understand that each decision you make, there's risk involved. Let's see what we can go ahead and reduce. Let's see what we're comfortable to live with.
So I guess you're using this visibility these days to plan where you're targeting your initiatives. What's next? So it sounds like you've just been getting a handle on things. What's the next big project for you? Because this sounds like the most major one in terms of, you know, pasting it into every corner of your infrastructure, whereas some of the other ones, they're sort of a little bit more centralized and stuff. What's next?
Well, I mean, one of the things I've realized is when you deal with organizations of this size, you don't really have a perimeter. You know, perimeters now are in these. They're in these, you know, devices that your users are running around with, the tablets and the phones. And so you've got this malleable perimeter. And so what I've looked at now is I'm starting to refocus as we're finishing building out the security program, is I'm focusing it down to the data level. And we're looking at data governance. I'm looking at where my data is at, who's accessing it, where it's stored, is it backed up, is it encrypted. I'm looking at, you know, what data is going to the cloud, you know, what third party, you know, partners do we have, you know, who, what are they accessing, and do they have rights to access
it? So I mean, it's find the CVEs and then find out where your data is. Seems like a good first principles approach, Gary.
And it's like, I'll tell you, and it's on a massive scale. And I mean, we're using a platform called Varonis that's allowing us to get very personal with the accounts and where the data is at. And at times, I swear, it's like chasing cats. But when you deal with networks of this size, you've got Nessus on the upper layer kind of giving you that big umbrella cover. And then you got to get down up underneath and go chasing the mushrooms and go chasing where is the data at, so that you can go ahead and figure out what you need to protect, what you need to pull offline. And now we're getting into the accounts, and we're also a lot of our privileged accounts. As to, you know, do these privileged accounts really need this level of access? And it's like, and the biggest things we're looking at now is when you have roughly 3,000 partners, you know, of all of these different, you know, whether it's vendors or whether it's, you know, other cities and county and federal agencies that you work with, you now we're starting to dig into that access. What are they actually accessing? What are they looking at? What are they taking with them when they log off? You know, should they have rights to that? And, you know, a lot of it is basic, you know, cyber hygiene, but on a almost like an industrial scale.
Gary Hayslip, thank you very much for joining us on Risky Business to have a bit of a chat about the, your busy weeks, I guess we'd say. It's been a pleasure to chat to you.
Oh, no problem. I've been a good time.
That was Gary Hayslip there. He is the CISO for the city of San Diego. And I've only been to San Diego once, but I would love to go back again one day. It's a really cool city. Great bars, awesome Mexican food, and great surf, even though it's bonkers crowded. So yes, big thanks to Tenable Network Security for sponsoring this week's show and connecting me with Gary for this week's sponsor interview. I think if you're in a position where you need to get a handle on how out of control your situation really is, Nessus is going to be a pretty good place to start. So you can check out Tenable at tenable.com. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.